Entertainment, or you can DM me at smallest_princessa on Instagram.
Good afternoon, this is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk for December 24th, which is a day before Christmas, so Merry Christmas. I'm actually taping this on the 21st. Actually, now it's the 22nd. It's past midnight. So welcome to the show. Like always, there's lots of things happening in astronomy. And the 21st was the solstice, the winter solstice. So in many countries, like China, it's a celebration. They celebrate it, called the winter solstice, and they have a special food for it. And here, it's the shortest day of the year with the least daylight. I wouldn't know that because it's probably going to be cloudy for a while now. And that's too bad because there's a spectacular sight now. I'm always talking about learning brand new words. And here's a new word for you, conjunction. So tonight and probably a few nights more than that, the planets of Jupiter and Saturn are in the line of sight. So they're closest together that they'll ever be. I believe Jupiter is 550 million miles away, which is about 900 million kilometers. And Saturn, I think it's about 1 billion miles away, which is 1.6 billion kilometers. So they're along the line of sight. And I heard on the news you could see them in the southwest sky. Probably closer to the horizon, but I'm looking out the window now, and the sky looks pretty cloudy, so probably couldn't see much. I'll go out later tonight. Maybe that'll be about 3:30 in the morning, and I'll see what I can see. But right now, oh, it looks not so bad, so I'll try to see it later. So it appears as I guess it appears as one star or one big star because the planets are so close. And if you had a telescope, you could see that there are two planets. So I'll try to go out later. I didn't go out earlier because, as I said, it's quite cold now. I was watching another show on BBC Earth tonight. It was about black holes and it wasn't like that spectacular when I watch somebody like, let's say, Brian Cox. And I don't want to criticize these people because they're super duper astronomers. They're professors. They're experts in their field. But the way Brian Cox's shows are put together, they're riveting. They really capture my attention. And this one, it was like, I didn't really care that I was watching it. I turned the station a couple times, maybe because all of us, even little kids, know what a black hole is and basically light can't escape from a black hole. But one thing that I guess it answered my question about a certain word called quasar. So if someone asked me, well, what's a neutron star? I could basically tell them. And what's a black hole? I could tell them. If someone would have asked me before tonight, even though I've come across the word so many times, quasar, if they asked me, what's a quasar? I say, well, it's an old TV set. Yeah, that's what they used to call a certain TV set, quasar. But a quasar is a quasi-stellar object, abbreviated QSO, big letters. And this is from the computer. Is an extremely luminous active galactic nucleus, AGN, in which a supermassive black hole with mass ranging from millions to billions of times the mass of the sun is surrounded by a gaseous accretion disk. So what I thought before is quasars could only be found in the early universe. And basically that's what this show said. Quasars were around billions of years ago. And possibly our black hole was a quasar before. So our galaxy had a quasar. See, I don't know what's the correct words to use. I don't say our galaxy was a quasar or our galaxy had a quasar. Sometimes there's a big difference in the meaning between those sentences. But basically what happens is if you have a black hole and there's an accretion disk around it, that means stuff is lining up to be sucked into the black hole. And the atoms are rubbing against each other, so they're creating friction. And that's what causes, I believe, the atoms to slow down and to eventually be sucked into the black hole. And X-rays are emitted, Ms. Schultz said tonight it's the most efficient form of light that's traveling into black hole. But again, I've said this about many other things. You have to be careful about the words you choose. So if we look at the Orion Galaxy, or the constellation of Orion, I think Rigel is a light blue star. It's heavier than Betelgeuse, but Betelgeuse is bigger because its layers are expanding out. I believe in the past few years, it's grown about 15%. So it's a dying star, it's a red giant. And it's less dense than Rigel because Rigel, I'm not sure how to say it, I've heard Rigel and Rigel, but let's say Rigel. So it's less dense than Rigel because its outer layers are expanding out. It's in its death throes, it's going to die maybe tomorrow, maybe in a million years, or maybe it's already died. But basically, got to be careful which words you use. So I think Rigel is heavier, but then Betelgeuse is bigger because its outer layers are expanding. So this show tonight said about the black hole or the quasars, they are the most energetic things in the universe. Well, okay, that's good that they said that, because does that mean they're emitting the most light or they're the brightest? So what I thought with energetic, it's more energetic, but again, does it emit the most light, or is it just the brightest, or is it most I'm not sure. See, you can tangle your words, but anyway, the show said tonight a quasar would be the most energetic thing, so I guess that means it's emitting the most energy. And if you follow the logic, then you can say, well, it's emitting the most light. So when you're talking about things like astronomy, you got to be very precise. So I learned that a quasar is a black hole, and right now our black hole in the center of our galaxy has stopped eating up gas. So it's not an active galactic nuclei. So it's just a black hole, just a run-of-the-mill supermassive black hole. So these supermassive black holes were active in the beginning of the universe, and then they've stopped sucking up gas. And the interesting thing the show said tonight was they control the black hole, or they control the galaxy. So they limit how big the galaxy can get in terms of how many stars it can produce. And the astronomer was saying, well, that's a puzzle or it was puzzling in the beginning years ago, because if you took a black hole, you can say it's the size of a grape, and the whole galaxy is the size of, let's say, planet Earth. So how can something so small like this black hole control the galaxy, which is so much bigger? But that's what they actually said. So I always knew there was an interplay between the galaxy itself and the black hole. And I also read years ago that it's like the chicken and the egg argument. Which came first, the black hole or the galaxy? Or did they grow hand in hand? And did they influence each other? But they were talking about this because this was a show about 3, 4, maybe 5 years old. And I remember a few years ago, there was a gas blob, I believe it was called G2, and it was heading towards the center of our galaxy. So they were predicting that our black hole would start to suck up the matter from this gas cloud, and then you could see an accretion disk. But I'm trying to recall, I think what actually happened was that after a few years, they said, oh, the G2 gas cloud actually missed our black hole. And here's a nice article. How G2 survived the black hole at our Milky Way's heart. So this is posted by Deborah Bird in Science Wire, November 4th, 2014. So again, the article is called How G2 Survived the Black Hole at Our Milky Way's Heart. So it said G2 survived. And it shows in 2011, astronomers said they discovered a cloud of gas with several times Earth mass, accelerating fast towards a supermassive black hole at the center of our Milky Way. the cloud appeared to be undergoing spaghettification, sometimes called the noodle effect, stretching and elongating as it neared the black hole. It was thought at first the cloud, which came to be called G2, would meet a fiery end as it passed into the Milky Way's black hole as early as 2013. It did not, but astronomers now say it passed closest to the black hole in northern summer of 2014. Unexpectedly, however, our galaxy's black hole did not swallow it. Instead, G2 survived. This week, November 3rd, 2014, so again, this article is from 2014, UCLA astronomers published a newspaper in the journal Astrophysical Journal Letters offering a new explanation as to why G2 is and how, as to what G2 is and how it survived the black hole passage. So the team now suggests that G2 is a pair of binary stars that had been orbiting the black hole in tandem and merged together into an extremely large star. That's very interesting. This merger may have been cloaked in gas and dust and choreographed by the object's proximity to the black hole's powerful gravitational field. They noted from UCLA that the massive stars in our galaxy primarily come in pairs. When the two stars merge into one, the star expands for more than 1 million years. Okay, so that's interesting. I didn't know that it was actually a star. So this definitely brought up that that memory when I watched that show last night about G2. So it survived the black hole, and it survived it more than 26,000 years ago, because as we know, the black hole at the center of our galaxy is 26,000 light years from us. But I'm going to read an article a bit later, and it's going to say that the black hole is actually closer to us than we thought before. So it's 2 million light years closer than it was before. So I am going to read that a bit later. And right now I'm going to go to another article. So there was quite a few things I had confirmed from that show I watched. I guess it was last night, because now it's the morning. And it was a bit ho-hum, because I thought, well, I'd been exposed to a lot of those ideas. And they didn't say much about the science of things. They just kept saying, oh, we're going to watch this. We're going to watch how gas gets devoured by a black hole. But then they actually, at the end of the show, they said, that's coming soon. We're gonna report on this soon. But it's still another bit of science. And I said before, as you know, we can learn astronomy from many different sources. And I particularly like this when you're watching TV, because you got professors that put together a professional show, and they really know what they're talking about. And tonight, as I said, a lot of the information was stuff that I already knew, and probably little kids already know. But it was interesting how they said before before the radio telescopes came in the 50s and the 60s, I believe it was Zwicky that had theories about black holes, and a lot of people didn't accept that, and especially somebody like Einstein. It seemed every time Einstein came up with a theory, he'd say later, well, I don't really think this could happen. For example, gravitational waves. And a lot of other scientists after Einstein tried to say, no, I don't think gravitational waves exist. I think a lot of other scientists said, no, they exist. And we know the cosmological constant, or that fudge factor that Einstein used to explain that the universe was not expanding when actually it was. And he said, it's the biggest blunder of my life. It seemed Einstein very often doubted his conclusions from the math and from his theories when he proclaimed a theory, and then later he'd have to apply it to something. He'd say, what, really? I don't think the universe can expand. I don't think gravitational waves could exist. And these all came out of his theories, and he believed in a lot of what he said, but then sometimes he just couldn't intuitively put the theories together, and when the conclusion came out, he'd say, I don't think so. But then a lot of people would say, yes, yeah, you're right. And I, this is one of my favorite stories of Chandra Shekhar. He was a grad student from India. He took a boat and from India to London, and on the voyage he basically figured out that once I believe it was about just neutron stars, not black holes, but he said stars could almost crush themselves out of existence, and people were saying no, that's not true. And Eddington, his professor in London, was looking over his shoulder and let her in a presentation. Eddington stood up and said, no, this is wrong, because it contradicted Eddington's line of belief. And a lot of people came up to Chandra Shekhar later and says, we actually believe you, but because the way science is, Eddington's really respected, we can't go counter to his belief. And I think this is one of the most painful periods of Chandra Shekhar's life. But people like Chandra Shekhar, Zwicky, and even Zwicky, I think, and Einstein, they came up with these brilliant theories that now we just, even little kids, if you ask them, well, what's a black hole? They could pretty well tell you correctly what a black hole is. And we seem to take for granted that black holes exist and all these things. But the radio telescopes and stuff of the 50s and 60s, when they came out, they discovered the quasars and a lot of the X-rays coming from black holes, and those became the signature. So if you see X-rays coming from a certain part of the sky, you think, oh, maybe that's a black hole, because gas is rushing into the center of the black hole and it's giving off X-rays as the gas is doing that. And I believe neutron stars do that too. So there was so much to learn from the TV stations. And now I am going to go for a break. And when I come back, I'm going to talk about the conjunction. So that's another word, conjunction. I'll talk about that later when I come back. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk. So I was talking a bit about quasars and black holes. And the Christmas star, or what's the Christmas star? It's the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. I believe that Jupiter and Saturn align like this. In our line, in our line of sight, it looks like they're close together, but they're actually like 500 million miles apart. But that's when they come the closest, and this happens every 800 years. So one of the things that I did see on the news tonight was when they talked about it, and last night as well, they talked about, well, could the Christmas star be the actually be the star of Bethlehem? So maybe that was, there were people thinking, well, maybe that's what happened. Jupiter and Saturn aligned, and that was the star that the three wise men followed to find Jesus. So if you look back, it's now it's 2000. So the Christmas star would have been visible 800 years ago. And then before that, it would have been 1600 years ago. And before that, it would have been 2400 years ago. So right now, we're about 2000 years from when Jesus was born. So basically, if people believe that, so the Christmas star would have been around 2400 years ago, which means 400 years before Christ was born. So I don't think so, but I'm going to read this article. It's by Rafi Letzer, a staff writer, 14 hours ago, which means it was published the 21st. And it said, could the Christmas star visible tonight actually be the star of Bethlehem? So this is on livescience.com. And how close does tonight's sky look to the sky at the time of Jesus's birth? So Here it shows a photo of Venus and Jupiter hang over a frozen United Kingdom during a previous apparent conjunction of planets. And when was that? It doesn't say. Was the Star of Bethlehem that led the Magi, or Magi, to the infant Jesus in the Bible, the same as the Christmas star that will be visible on Monday, December 21st. Oh yeah, and today is the winter solstice, so it was the shortest day of the year, the least light of the year, so it's going to get, the sun's going to rise a bit earlier every day and set a bit later, so at first it's just going to be minutes, but then later we'll notice in a few months. In other words, we'll be seeing what the wise men ostensibly saw 2,000 years ago. It wouldn't be crazy to think so. Jupiter and Saturn will come together on Monday, nearly merging in the sky, a phenomenon known as the Great Conjunction that happens roughly once every 20 years. Oh, it happens once every 20 years. I thought it happened once every 800 years. Jupiter and Saturn may have appeared to come together three times as they danced around each other in the sky during a period of conjunction close to when Jesus was reportedly born, during the year 7 BC. It's conceivable that combined light in the sky was recorded as a star and is associated with Jesus' birth and thus named the Christmas star according to Earth's sky. That, in fact, is why the Great Conjunction, as it's more correctly called, is also known as the Christmas star because of its connection with the birth of Jesus. So here's a story, or a video, if you want to say, they talk about, was the Star of Bethlehem the planetary conjunction? And again, this article is on livescience.com. The name of the article is, Could the Christmas Star Visible Tonight Actually Be the Star of Bethlehem? And it's by Rafi Letzer, L-E-T-Z-T-E-R. And it was written on the 21st. So I'm going to continue with the story. If the biblical count is any indication, it does seem like people remembered seeing something bright in the sky back then. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem, saying, Where is he who has been born the King of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. So this is Matthew 2:1, New American Standard Bible. And lo, the star which they had seen in the east went on before them until it came and stood over where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And they came into the house and saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. So this is Matthew 2:9, New Standard Bible. So according to the Gospel of Matthew, a bright star in the sky at the time of Jesus' birth announced his birth. But what was it? Winding back the orbits of the planet to the time of Jesus is fairly simple. For you, as Astronomy magazine reported, Jupiter and Saturn orbits aligned in 7 BC, such as that from Earth, they appeared to come together three times in the constellation Pisces, a relatively rare event, first proposed as the Star of Bethlehem in the 1600s by Johannes Kepler. According to NASA, before December 21st, 2020, Jupiter and Saturn hadn't come so close together in the sky for 400 years, and not at night for nearly 800 years. So that's where I heard the 800 years. Meanwhile, as Life Science has previously reported, the exact time of Jesus' birth is uncertain. But if the Star of Bethlehem was a planetary conjunction, astronomy reported, a Jupiter-Saturn pair up isn't the only candidate. In 3 BC, Jupiter and Venus came just as close from Earth's point of view as this year's Jupiter-Saturn conjunction, and Venus usually looks brighter from Earth than both Jupiter and Saturn. They then appeared to merge into a single star in June of 2 BC. So again, they're talking in video more about this. Planetary conjunctions aren't the only options, astronomy noted. Chinese astrologers noted a broom star in the sky in 5 BC, like a comet that could also explain the Star of Bethlehem. And supernovas throughout history have looked to people on Earth like big bright stars. But there's no evidence of a supernova around the time of Jesus' birth. So I wonder at that time, thousands of years ago, how wonderful the sky must have looked. Writing for The Conversion, Eric M. Vanden Eickel, a professor of religion at Ferrum College in Virginia, said, and quote, I believe Matthew's story of the star exists not to inform readers about a specific astronomical event, but to support claims that he is making about the character of Jesus, end quote. In other words, maybe Matthew, writing decades after Jesus' death, wasn't recalling something physical seen in the sky, but instead a spiritual idea. So I wonder how somebody could come to our planet, an alien, and then they see we worship Christ, we have Christmas, and they could probably relate to us about their great conjunctions in their wherever they come from. Now here's an article I'm going to read just briefly. It's by Gina Briner, Life Science and Editor-in-Chief. It was published December 21st, and it says, how to watch tonight's great conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. This evening, on the first day of astronomical winter, you may be able to see a rare phenomenon witnessed when the famous astronomer Galileo Galilei was alive. Jupiter and Saturn will be so close, appear to be so close to one another in the night sky, the gassy behemoths will look like one star, the Christmas star. Called the Great Conjunction, the seemingly snuggled up planets will appear just a tenth of a degree apart, or about one-fifth the diameter of a full moon. While the Great Conjunction occurs every 20 years, the planets haven't been this close to each other since July 16, 1623, or 397 years ago, according to timeanddate.com. And the last time the planets were this close to each other at night, when the sun's glare didn't make it impossible to see, was in 1223, nearly 800 years ago. How can you catch the Great Conjunction? Shortly after sunset in the northern hemisphere, look into the southwestern sky and you should see the duo shining brightly. Hold your pinky finger at arm's length once you spot the spot, and that should be enough to block out Jupiter and Saturn, which are 11 and 9 times the diameter of Earth, respectively. The Great Conjunction should also be visible from the southern hemisphere, just in the western sky. Jupiter, being the solar system's largest planet, will be the brightest of the two. Wherever you are on Earth, the Great Conjunction will occur near the horizon. If you get out your sky-watching binoculars or a telescope, the duo will show up in the same field of view, Life Science reported. Though you should be able to see the heavenly sight for the rest of December, the two planets will be outshined by the sun come January. Okay, and there's live webcasts of the Great Conjunction, Lowell Observatory, SLOOH's YouTube channel. The Great Conjunction would be webcast by Vanderbilt Dyer Observatory at Vanderbilt University, and the online Observatory Virtual Telescope Project will webcast the conjunction in from Sassano, Italy. So it shows here there's Jupiter, Europa, Io, Callisto, and Saturn. So beautiful sight. And on another photo I saw earlier, there was a lot of other stars close by. And I don't know if I can, so it's the 22nd right now. So if I go out, it's 3 in the morning. I'll go out later, and on my next show, I'll tell you guys what I saw. Okay, now let's talk about our galaxy supermassive black hole is close. That's the article I was looking for. So our galaxy supermassive black hole is closer than we thought. And there's so many things, like for example, when Andromeda merges with our galaxy, they said it's going to be in 5 million years. It could be earlier than that. And before, there was a speculation about when animals will die out. That has changed as well. They said the reign of the animals will be over in 500 million years. So there's all these new data and sea level rise. They keep revising that and saying, oh, it's going to be quicker than we thought. Arctic ice is going to melt quicker than we think. So there's lots of things that are constantly being revised. So this is one of them. Again, the article is called Our Galaxy Supermassive Black Hole is Closer to Earth Than We Thought. It is by Diane Lincoln on LifeScience.com. And it was 2 days ago, which is December 19th. So I'm going to start reading this. And it says here, the European Southern Observatory's gravity instrument revealed clumps of gas swirling around just outside the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. Here, a visualization of that orbiting gas. So I thought the gas had stopped orbiting, but I guess it's not. I guess what the show said the other day was, is the gas being sucked in. It could orbit, but being sucked in is a different thing. And one of the things that show did say was, when you look at the, for example, the black hole at the center of our galaxy, if it's looked at by a visible telescope as opposed to an X-ray, you see different things. And the X-ray telescope reveals so many things, and maybe the radio telescope as well, that the visible telescope would not reveal. So here goes the article. Again, it's in LiveScience.com. It's called "Our Galaxy Supermassive Black Hole is Closer to Earth Than We Thought" by Diane Lincoln, December 19th. The supermassive black hole hiding in the center of our galaxy is much closer to Earth, about 2,000 light years closer, than scientists thought, according to new research out of Japan. Not only that, but our solar system is moving faster than thought as it orbits this galactic center. All this doesn't mean you need to worry that Earth is zooming towards the center. Toward the central behemoth. All this doesn't mean you need to worry that Earth is zooming towards the central behemoth or that we will get sucked up by the gravity monster, the researchers noted. We are still quite a ways from the black hole, dubbed Sagittarius A star, SAG A star, 25,800 light years, where one light year is about 6 trillion miles or 9.5 trillion kilometers. So, just to make clear, the show tonight said there's stuff orbiting the black hole, and stuff can orbit a black hole, but what happens to some of the gas molecules orbiting is they start to rub against each other and emits X-ray light, and then I think, I'm not sure when it starts emitting X-ray light, but apparently what happens with the gas as it rubs against each other, it starts to maybe lose energy or lose velocity, and then it starts getting falling in towards the black hole. And as it falls more and more into the black hole, it's like a whirlpool when you open the plug of your sink and the water, there's a big whirlpool of water moving into the sink. That's what happens with the gas molecules. And they start rubbing against each other and then falling faster and faster and deeper into the black hole. So I guess I have a comment about a black hole. If black holes are black holes, they exist, so they're in our universe. But then scientists often say, once you get inside the black hole, you exit the universe. Maybe they mean the known universe, but it's true that they say that the laws of physics break down inside the black hole. But can they say that it exits our universe, because black holes are in our universe? So the matter that goes inside the black hole exit our universe. So that's what I hear very often. So anybody know any better than that, please let me know. Okay, the study is part of the VERA experiment, that's V-E-R-A, or the VLBI exploration of radio astrometry, whose aim is to explore the three-dimensional structure of the Milky Way. Since we live within the Milky Way, scientists can't just take a snapshot of it to figure out its structure. Instead, they take precise measurements of star sizes, position, and orbital velocities, how fast they circle the galactic center, in a scientific field called astrometry. I learned another word tonight. The resulting maps can shed light on details of our Milky Way, the stars in it, and possibly the universe. Okay, I'm going to go for a break now. When I come back, we're going to talk more black holes. Strange, this show seems to have evolved into the black hole show, which I didn't really expect, but I'm just following what these articles are telling me. So thank you for listening. We are talking black holes and astronomy on AstroTalk. This is Marco on CITR 101.9.
Come and feel our positive energy at Falun Dafa Fellowship. Falun Dafa, also called Falun Gong, is an ancient spiritual discipline based on the principles of truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance. It's a self-cultivation practice that improves mental and physical wellness through meditation and simple exercises. It's been well documented to improve mind and body, relieve stress and anxiety, increase energy and vitality, and promote morality and spirituality. Why not give yourself a chance to learn free of charge? To learn more, please visit our website at falundafafellowship.com.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Okay, welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. I'm reading an article from LiveScience.com. It's called "Our Galaxy's Supermassive Black Hole is Closer to Earth Than We Thought." This is dated December 19th, but on LiveScience.com, they just say 2 days ago, and it's by Diane Lincoln. So let's keep reading about this new finding about the distance of Sagittarius A star from us, so the distance from us to the center of the Milky Way. Researchers can now measure distances of stars located farther and 30,000 light years from our solar system, said Tomoya Hirota, a professor in the Department of Astronomy at Songkendai and the leader of the data analysis team in Vera. Okay, in this article it shows, this says, zoom into a Milky Way supermassive black hole, the European Southern Observatory gravity instrument aboard the aboard the VLIB exploration of radio astrometry. This is a video about it, and it's again on LiveScience.com. The article's called "Our Galaxy's Supermassive Black Hole is Closer to Earth Than We Thought," by Diane Lincoln, December 19th. So I'd love to play this video, but you're not going to hear it. So anyway, here's a subtitle, Measuring a Monster. How do you measure the distance to a black hole as monstrous as Sagittarius A star, weighing in at 4.2 million times the mass of the Sun? Very precisely. To do this, the researchers with Vera used four VLBI telescopes, so it's called Very Long Baseline Interferometry telescopes in Japan. These observatories work together to achieve results comparable to one telescope with a diameter about 1,400 miles or 2,300 kilometers across. The resolution is so sharp that when compared to human eyesight, it would be like seeing a penny on the surface of the moon. However, Vera is designed to see things that are much farther away than the moon. For instance, Vera can distinguish the annual position shift of a star within 10 microarc seconds, which is an angle of 1 over 360 million of the distance between two tick marks on a protractor. Using the four telescope, researchers were able to measure the accurate position, sizes, and orbital velocities of Milky Way star. Vera published a catalog of 99 Milky Way objects. From the cataloged information, they constructed a position and velocity map. This map helped them project orbits around the galactic center and in turn hone in on its location. With this new location, they figured out the more accurate velocity of the solar system. So I just read that article, or read that paragraph, and they said, oh, okay, they just constructed a position and velocity map. They used four telescopes, blah, blah, blah. I can't imagine how complicated this is. When I was watching the show on astronomers, and they successfully photographed the black hole or the gas around it, the algorithms apparently are so complicated. They have to write computer algorithms for the whole process. So to do this science, it's just an undertaking that's unbelievable. And these astronomers continue to impress. And I can't believe how complicated and probably the algorithms and everything they have to figure out. So bravo for them. They use this information to reveal our location within the Milky Way and to determine the three-dimensional velocity and spatial structure of the galaxy, which is a barred spiral. They found that Sagittarius A star is 2,000 light years closer to Earth than the International Astronomical Union, or IAU, determined in 1985. Furthermore, our solar system is traveling 510,000 miles per hour, or 227 kilometers per second, which is faster than the earlier official recorded speed. So I'm going to write that down because that's amazing. Because I sometimes want to remember certain things and I don't write it down. And I try to remember. So 510,000 miles per hour, or 227 kilometers per second. That's the speed of the solar system as it travels around our Milky Way center, and it's faster than the recorded earlier records. Vera's measurements are thought to be more accurate than past ones because the group used more advanced technology and corrected for how the Earth's atmosphere blurred out earlier measurements. The new finding also agrees with a distant measurement reported in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics in 2019, which put Earth around 26,660 light years from Sagittarius A star. Nicholas Suntzeff, distinguishing professor and lecturer and director of the astronomy program at Texas A&M University, told Life Science. As such, Suntzeff wondered why the team compared this result primarily with the 1985 data rather than his more recent measurements in an experiment called Gravity. So big G, big R, big A, big V, big I, big T, big Y, which involves the gravity instrument attached to the European Southern Observatory's ESO, Very Large Telescope, VLT, in northern Chile. Just a comment here about telescopes. Astronomers often do this. They group telescopes together to expand the, I don't know what the correct word is, expand the viewing power, not the magnification, but how much information they could take in. It's just amazing how scientists can do that. So Hirota agreed that Vera findings should be compared to gravity. Here says Hirota, and quote, "An important point is that we estimate the same parameters independently from the gravity results by using a different method," end quote. Okay, the new findings have implications for solving some of the most enduring mysteries in astronomy. So says Hirota again, end quote, "These results can be used to estimate other astronomical parameters, such as the distribution of dark matter and its density around the solar system, and could even help scientists predict how often we should see hypothetical dark matter particles if they exist." End quote. Said Hirota, whose group has been working to improve astrometry techniques. So that's another word I learned tonight. Astrometry. So let me write that down. STRometry, which means measurement of things. Many dark matter searches rely on a wind of dark matter blowing through the solar system. It is thought that some of the dark matter will interact with Earth-based detectors. Faster dark matter will make larger signals. If the Vera experiment is correct and the solar system is moving more quickly, it is possible that dark matter might be easier to detect than scientists currently think. In their next collaboration, the Vera researchers will look at objects even closer at the heart of the Milky Way. With each measurement, we will better know our place in the universe. Okay, so I think that was an interesting article, and I guess critics might point out that, well, we have coronavirus, we have poverty on Earth, we have hunger, and scientists are spending lots of money to discover that we're closer to our galaxy's supermassive black hole than we thought. And there's a lot of other things they could spend money on. And of course, there's this big pie of knowledge, and I guess everything that is learned about astronomy is part of that pie. And as it said here, one thing of one branch of knowledge influences and makes it easier to discover things in another branch of astronomy. So I guess that's the thing I could say in terms of being a supporter of any kind of astronomy research. But hopefully one day, like, who knows what's going to happen when, because gravitational waves were actually detected a few years ago, can something come out of that? Because about 100 years ago, 120 years ago, there was a lot of things on particles and atomic theory and quantum mechanics, and they were turned into very useful things like electronics and things like this. So hopefully this all becomes part of the puzzle, but then we can't stop searching and striving like we always have as human beings for what is out there, the truth. And so I'm very supportive of this. Okay, so let's talk about now, because I love astronomy, of course. So let's talk about a gargantuan chunk of cosmic web discovered. It's 50 million light years long. So gargantuan chunk of cosmic web discovered. It's 50 million light years long. So what could be 50 million light years long? So this is on by Brandon Spector, senior writer, 21 hours ago. So it's dated December 21st. So let me speculate before I read the article. I think it could be a big wall of galaxies or a filament or a big stretch of interconnected galaxies. So let's read what it says. Okay, so here it shows a picture and it says, this optical image of the Abel 3391/95 system is superimposed onto the other images showing the density of gas. Darker areas have higher density and the radio outlines yellow. Okay, so again, this article is called Gigantic Chunk of Cosmic Web Discovered. It's 50 million light years long on LiveScience.com by Brandon Spector. So I'm going to start reading the article. The map of our universe looks astonishingly like a road map of the United States. Big, bustling clusters of galaxies swell like brightly lit cities, while long, sparse highways of gas connect them in a gigantic molecular web. Beyond this web, dark, empty space. Nowhere worth stopping for a selfie anyway. So what I do recall is, could the empty space be voids? I'm not sure, but there's lots of empty space. And I know where some empty space is between my ears, but there's a lot of empty space in the universe. And these voids mean something. And I won't say any more because I'll show how much I don't know, but there are empty space called voids. Astronomers believe this cosmic web is a vestige of the early universe when big clouds of gas grew denser and denser as their gravity drew more and more matter toward them. Today, these galaxy clusters are the largest known structures in the universe, each one containing hundreds of thousands or individual galaxies and billions of stars. So as I speculated, I guess they are galaxy clusters, but what else could they be, right? These clusters are easy enough to see with good telescopes, but the long, wispy roads or filaments between them, however, are much harder to detect. Now, using a powerful X-ray telescope, astronomers believe... I'm going to click that to open it, and then I'll read about this X-ray telescope. There, okay, it opened. So, let me read that again. I'll read the sentence before. Those clusters are easy enough to see with good telescopes, but the long wispy roads or filaments between them, however, are much harder to detect. Now, using a powerful X-ray telescope, astronomers believe they've taken one of the clearest images of a filament ever, or at least one of the longer. So let's see. It says here in this article that I opened, it said, what are X-rays? So X-rays are types of electromagnetic radiation, probably more well known for their ability to see through a person's skin and reveal bones beneath it. So I'm going to read about that later, but right now I'm going to go back to this article. And there's another thing here, it says related to 12 strangest objects in the universe. If I have time, I'll read that later. So again, this article is called Gargantuan Chunk of Cosmic Web Discovered. It's 50 million light years long. So here's a video, recommended video for you. It's the same video. It's the same lady. That's why I recognize her. They're talking about Jupiter and Saturn in the sky. So, in a study published December 4th in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, researchers studied an object called A3391/95, a group of three galaxy clusters sitting some 700 million light years from Earth. So, using the small e, big R, big O, big S, big I, big T, big A X-ray telescope, or E. Rosetta X-ray telescope, the team not only saw the three individual clusters, but also the enormous gas filament connecting them. According to the team's calculations, this filament stretches more than 50 million light years across, the single largest ever captured in an image. So again, I've mentioned this before, if you probably look through a telescope, you see what you see, but these astronomers probably focus their telescope on that thing for a long time and gather light over many hours or many days. So they probably, in their computer image, is probably much more spectacular than what you can see if you put an eyepiece up to the telescope, but it would still be spectacular. This finding is exciting. So what's the finding? The filament stretches for more than 50 million light years across. This finding is exciting, as filaments are thought to contain an enormous proportion of the universe's missing baryonic matter, that is, matter made up of protons and neutrons. So said Thomas Reiprecht, an astronomer at the University of Bonn in Germany, and quote, "According to our calculations, more than half of all baryonic matter in our universe is contained in these filaments," end quote. Astronomers have calculated that all the galaxies in the cosmos account for only 40% of the universe's baryonic matter. The remainder is thought to reside inside the filaments between the galaxy clusters, although proving that with concrete evidence is difficult. Astronomers have calculated that all the galaxies in the cosmos only account for 40% of the universe's baryonic matter. The remainder is thought to reside inside the filaments between galaxy clusters, although proving that with concrete evidence is difficult. The gas inside these filaments is so diluted, less than 10 particles per cubic meter, according to the researchers, that imaging them has been near impossible. With those filaments finally showing up in X-ray images of distant galaxy clusters, astronomers may finally be able to study their wispy depths and find out if they really do contain the universe's missing matter. Okay, I like this stuff. This is like astronomy. This is really hardcore astronomy. Maybe it's called cosmology, but it's the stuff that I was attracted to first, but then later Brian Cox let me see the light, and I'm attracted to bioastrophysics, I guess you can call it, maybe. But I'm still really into this stuff. So I'm going to go into this next article. I just opened it from the previous article, which said there's a gigantic chunk of cosmic web that's 50 million light years long. And in that article, it said, "What are X-rays?" So I'm going to read this. This is "What are X-rays?" That's the name of the article by Jim Lucas, Life Science contributor, October 5, 2018. So X-rays are a very energetic form of electromagnetic radiation, or light, that can be used to take images of the human body. X-rays are a type of electromagnetic radiation, probably most well known for ability to see through a person's skin and reveal images of the bone beneath it. Advances in technology have led to more powerful and focused X-ray beams, as well as ever greater applications of these light waves, from imaging teensy biological cells and structural components of materials like cement to killing cancer cells. X-rays are roughly classified into soft X-rays and hard X-rays. Soft X-rays have relatively short wavelengths of about 10 nanometers, that's 10 to the minus meter. It's 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter, I'm sorry about that. And so they fall into the range of the electromagnetic spectrum between ultraviolet light and gamma rays, so they're very short wavelengths. Hard X-rays have wavelengths of about 100 picometers, so a picometer is 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter. These electromagnetic waves occupy the same region of the electromagnetic spectrum as gamma rays. So what separates them? The only difference between them is their source. X-rays are produced by accelerating electrons, whereas gamma rays are produced by atomic nuclei in one of four nuclear reactions. History of X-rays. X-rays were discovered in 1895 by Wilhelm Conrad Roentgen, a professor at Würzburg University in Germany. According to the Non-Destructive Resource Center History of Radiography, Roentgen noticed crystals near a high-voltage cathode tube exhibiting a fluorescent glow, even when he shielded them with dark paper. Some form of energy was being produced by the tube that was penetrating the paper and causing the crystals to glow. Roentgen called the unknown energy X radiation. Experiments showed that this radiation could penetrate soft tissues but not bone, and would produce shadow images on photographic plates. For his discovery, Roentgen was awarded the very first Nobel Prize in Physics in 1901. So that's an example of science working. Roentgen noticed something, he followed it, and bang, he discovered X-rays. And how valuable have X-rays been? And the whole electromagnetic spectrum, how we've tamed it and used it. So when I always hear comments about, well, maybe astronomy isn't so useful, why are they spending money on this, that, and the other thing? Well, this, that, and the other thing could actually lead to some really good spin-offs, or we'll see what gravitational waves can bring us. So thank you for listening. This whole show was about, I guess, astrophysics or cosmology. So I love this show. I love all shows to do with astronomy. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You have been listening to AstroTalk for Thursday, December 24th, 2020. Have a Merry Christmas. Yeah, check it out.